there. We aren't poets after all. Dylan and Amari, go on and start us off. Dylan crushes the egg in his palm and unfolds the paper inside. I read as fast as I can. That thing in the shed, was it even real? The girl on the phone says, it's no big deal. He can't believe it, it tried to eat me. The girl on the phone disagrees completely. I'm a surgeon, I'll fetch my laser. Please calm down, help's on the way, sir. A bit more fussing, then, finally they're here, and with the press of a button, she erases his fear. Has to be the Department of Half-Truths and Full Cover-Ups, says Dylan. They're responsible for any accidental contact between humans and the supernatural world. Right, I say. All 911 calls that deal with the supernatural get forwarded to the call center. Dylan and I race out of the auditorium and down the main hall of the Department of Supernatural Investigations to the elevators. I glance over my shoulder as Luciano, the elevator, opens up in front of us. As our doors close, the rest of the trainees come storming out of the auditorium. The treasure hunt is officially on. I'm actually glad that we got Luciano. He may not move as fast as Lucy, but he sings us a soft ballad that calms my nerves. Dylan can't keep still. He's so worked up. He keeps bouncing back and forth from foot to foot. Now approaching the Department of Half-Truths and Full Cover-Ups, croons Luciano. The doors open up to what I think is the coolest lobby in the whole bureau. It's pretty much the wall over Elsie's bed on steroids. Every inch is lined with covers from famous magazines from the known world, like Time and National Geographic, only they've changed the pictures to show what really happened. I've only seen the lobby a few times when somebody else would get off on this floor, but I've got a favorite cover that I look for every time. Instead of that famous Life magazine cover showing an astronaut on the moon, it says, Apollo 11 gets tow from friendly alien cruiser after running out of fuel. The image of Neil Armstrong reaching out into space to give a hitchhiker's thumb cracks me up every time. The invasion of mutant concrete-eating termites that brought the Berlin Wall down is definitely second place. The giant termites are all wearing Mutants for World Peace t-shirts. Me and Dylan rush through the lobby and into the main hall. It's like 10 times as busy as the Department of Supernatural Investigations. Who are all these people? It's a good thing we learned these floors by heart, or I'd have no idea where to go next. We keep close to the wall and move around the right side of the U till we get to the call center. The place is enormous. Rows and rows and rows of people sit in little cubicles in front of bright red telephones. The place seems to go on forever. What now? I ask. Dylan shrugs. So we wander the aisles, listening to double talkers and junior double talkers at work. You say your mother-in-law is haunting you? Assuming what you're saying is true, might you deserve it? Try 2 + 2. The calculator said it equals 5. Oh, this is serious. The math gods are clearly upset with you. You'll be wanting to make an in-person apology. You can make an appointment at the nearest tax office. One junior double talker puts his caller on hold to ask the girl in the cubicle next to him. Jenny, any chance you brought a spare hypnosis radio? Jenny rolls her eyes. Yes, but this is the last time I'm letting you borrow it. You don't have to replace everyone's memories, you know. She reaches into her bag and hands the boy something that looks like a TV remote. I recognize it from the delivery guy who dropped off Quentin's briefcase. You're a lifesaver. The boy mashes a few buttons, and soft music starts playing. He places his caller on speakerphone. Are you listening? Yes, that is some smooth jazz, isn't it? Now then, repeat after me. That wasn't a mummy I saw in the woods, but rather an unfortunate fellow who survived a plane crash and needed a full body cast. Yes. I dare say the bloke might be a bit put off by you running away in terror and all. No, definitely don't go back and apologize. Dylan and I walk the entire first two aisles before we spot an empty cubicle with a little sign that says, "Reserved for junior agent trainees," attached to the phone. I plop down in the chair, and Dylan drops to a knee beside me. It starts ringing. "I bet we're supposed to answer it," says Dylan. "But, oh, okay." I pick up the phone. "Hello? I've got a bit of an issue," the voice responds. "Okay. Maybe I can help," I ask. "What's wrong?" "Well, I seem to have a clue, and no one to tell it to," says the voice. My eyes go wide, and I turn to meet Dylan's curious gaze. "It's the next clue." I put the caller on speakerphone. "You can tell it to us." The voice clears his throat. "Finding this clue was easy enough. But don't you get cocky, 'cause now it gets tough. Head to a room of dangerous things, fangs and claws and barbs that sting. Locate the beast that's not like the rest, with a heavenly name created in jest." I swallow. The only department that keeps beasts is the Department of Creature Control. Fangs and claws? It must be the predator section, right? No way they'd really let us get eaten. Dylan lets out a nervous laugh. At least I don't think they'd let us get eaten. We get Lucy this time, and she zips us up to the Department of Creature Control. I know from cramming ins and outs that the Department of Creature Control is the largest floor in the entire bureau. It's as big as all the other departments combined. Aside from the lobby, it's all wilderness. Well, an indoor wilderness. "I'm the senior wilderness ranger assigned to you guys today," says a lady in safari gear. "Name's Becca Alford." She gives each of us a gloved handshake. "So, where to?" "The predator section," says Dylan. The lady smiles. "Scary place for newcomers. You sure?" "Pretty sure," I say. Ranger Alford gives us a thumbs up. "Follow me outside. I've already got the Jeep running." We step out of the lobby onto a grassy hilltop, and my jaw drops. You'd never know we were still indoors. The massive hologram on the ceiling looks just like a cloudless blue sky. I can even feel the warmth of the sun on my face. Real wind whips around us. It even smells like the outdoors. And this view. A wide forest stretches below us, and beyond that is a lush green jungle. To our right, way in the distance, is a snowy valley. It's the exact opposite of the sandy desert far off to our left. I reach down and pluck a blade of grass. "No way! This is real!" Ranger Alford laughs. "Sure is. The only thing that's fake out here is the sky. We've done everything in our power to give these critters as authentic a habitat as we can while they're here." "Cool," I say. We hop in the Jeep, and Ranger Alford drives us down a winding dirt trail. As the woods thicken into jungle, we pass all kinds of wildlife, everything from a silvery white unicorn to a pack of flying pigs, and even a kaleidoscopic serpent that leaves a shimmering rainbow trail in the sky. We slow to a stop in front of a sign that says, "Jungle Habitat." Ranger Alford turns to face us in the back seat. "The jungle predators are all kept in this first section. Remember, the things we're about to see in here are called predators for a reason. Don't leave the Jeep unless I say it's safe. You two are allowed to ask me as many questions as you like, but if I have to step in to save either of you, you'll both automatically fail the tryout. Got it?" "Got it," we both answer. We continue down the dirt trail, but a lot slower. Ranger Alfred's expression is serious now, and she's constantly watching the trees. I jump in my seat when, out of nowhere, a streak of gold flashes across the trail in front of us. It disappears into the bushes. A deafening roar rattles the Jeep doors. Dylan and I both lean into one another and duck our heads, just in case whatever that was tries to take a swipe at us. As the trail curves, we catch sight of a gigantic lion made of pure gold atop a small hill. "That's a Nemean lion," whispers Ranger Alfred. "The true kings of the jungle, at least when there aren't any dragons around." And that's not even the scariest thing we encounter. A swamp beast, covered in horns, peers up at us through the murky water. Dylan points out a griffin that swoops down in the distance and emerges with some poor creature in its beak. "Stop!" Dylan shouts. He points to a large flowery bush and a small clearing. "There! That's it! It has to be!"
"We're here for a flower bush?"
I ask, unimpressed. "That's no flower bush," he says. "That's a Mars man trap. Think about it. Locate the beast that's not like the rest. All the other predators are animals. This is the only plant. And the second part, the heavenly name created in jest, well, the planet Mars is in space, making it a heavenly body. And it's called a Mars man trap as a joke, comparing it to the Venus flytraps of the known world." Ranger Alfred grins at us in the rearview mirror. "Shucks, you nailed it." She steers the Jeep into the clearing.
"Good job," I say, a little stunned.
I'd never have figured that one out. "My tutor would be proud," Dylan says with a laugh. We jump out of the truck. Becca and Dylan are quick to squeeze their noses shut. But why? The sweetest scent hits my nose, and I suddenly get lightheaded. Not that I care. I just want to go over and smell those beautiful flowers up close. I take a few steps, and then feel myself get yanked back. Somebody has the nerve to throw an arm around me and put their hand over my nose. "Let me go! I want one of those flowers." I blink a couple times as my head clears. "The scent lures you in close so it can eat you," says Dylan.
"Be careful," Ranger Alfred warns.
"If it looks like one of you two are in real danger, I won't hesitate to step in." That was a close one. I reach up to hold my own nose. "Thanks, I'm good now." Dylan points to a small white rectangle just in front of the flower bush. I'll bet that's the next clue. But how do we get to it without becoming that thing's dinner?
"Good question," he replies.
Good question. I remember what Ranger Alfred said earlier. "You said we could ask questions, right?"
"That's right," she replies.
"How does it know when you're close to it?"
"Some of those blossoms are actually eyes," she answers. "It's watching us right now." Well, that's creepy, but it also gives me an idea.
"Hey, follow me."
I lead Dylan and Ranger Alfred out of the clearing. We all crouch behind the Jeep.
"Okay, don't freak out, but I want to show you something."
They look at me, confused.
"You want to show us something now?" asks Dylan. "Just watch."
I make a fist and cover it with my other hand.
Duplicata.
A second me pops into existence. Dylan holds in a laugh, but Ranger Alfred swallows, then asks,
"Is that magic?"
I nod, "But I think I can use it to help us, if you'll give me permission. I just have to hope our chaperone is open-minded enough to give me a chance."
"Well," Ranger Alfred looks uncomfortable. "Spells aren't really allowed inside the Bureau."
She shakes her head slowly.
"But it doesn't sit right with me for all the others to be allowed to use their abilities,
and you not. And I suppose no one said it was against the rules of the tryout. A few minutes later, we're all in position, me underneath the Jeep with a view of the clearing. Dylan and Ranger Alfred wait in the brush at the edge of the clearing. Dylan gives me a thumbs up. This had better work, because if it doesn't, Ranger Alfred made it clear she'll disqualify us.
Duplicata, I whisper.
An illusion of me appears in the clearing. I try to give illusion Amari a dazed look as she stumbles toward the flowers. From here, I see the bush shiver as she gets closer. Just a few more steps. A great big mouth emerges from the bushes, chomping at the air where illusion Amari stands. But now I make illusion Amari hover in the air just above the plant. It snaps viciously at her, again and again. While the beast is distracted, Dylan and Ranger Alfred dash out into the clearing. Dylan snatches the envelope off the ground, and they both make it back to the Jeep without the Mars Mantrap even realizing what happened. I let Illusion Amari disappear, and the thing lets out a furious growl.
I can't believe that worked,
says Dylan as he rips open the envelope.
Me neither, says a stunned Ranger Alfred. You were supposed to feed it the slumber berries in these bushes, but you managed it well enough.
Dylan rips open the envelope and pulls out the next clue. Congratulations on not being food, but I do hope you're in a deciphering mood. Your next destination, put clear and plain, is the baffling Department of the Unexplained. Obtaining the last clue will require some wit, for it lies near the bottom of a bottomless pit.
At least we know where to go, I say.
Dylan groans, for all the good that does us. As we ride back to the lobby of the Department of Creature Control, I catch Ranger Alfred looking at me in the rearview mirror.
You can control your magic?
She asks me.
So far, I shrug. I really only know a few things.
But I was always told. I thought that too much magic.
She shakes her head.
You're just an ordinary 12-year-old girl, from what I can tell. Smiling, good-natured. I guess what I'm trying to say is, you're not what I was expecting.
I smile. That's a good thing, I hope.
It certainly is, she says. I'll think you'll change a lot of minds while you're here, Amari Peters.
Once we're back at the lobby, me and Dylan sprint back to the elevators. I spend the whole ride down to the Department of the Unexplained, praying mischief won't snitch on me for sneaking out to go meet Magician Girl 18, aka Dylan, to the two agents sharing the elevator with us. Thankfully, all it does is taunt them with an, I know something you don't know. The lobby of the Department of the Unexplained is pitch black. When we step off the elevator, a spotlight in the ceiling shines down on us. It follows us to the back of the lobby, where a second spotlight shines down on a boy, fast asleep. Dylan gives him a nudge, and the boy jumps to his feet.
Ah, there you are, the boy says.
Many apologies. Our department is closed during the day, so I'd usually be in bed right now. Anyway, I'll be your guide tonight. I mean, today. I trust you know where you're headed.
The bottomless pit? I say.
Right, answers the boy. Unexplained oddities are on the right side of the U. Please follow me.
Aren't you going to tell us your name? Dylan asks.
The boy turns around. No, and for that matter, I don't plan on answering any of your questions either. You do get that you're in the Department of the Unexplained. Our junior curator leads us into the main hallway, which is at least a little brighter. It's still dim enough that these spotlights continue to follow us around, but a bit of light reaches us from all the great big rooms blocked off by dark red curtains. We pass one curtain with a sign out front that reads, "What happens when an unstoppable force strikes an immovable object?" Dylan drifts closer,
But the boy says, without even turning around, "Lay a finger on that curtain, and you're disqualified."
"Not even a peek?"
asks Dylan. "No questions," says the boy. The next curtain says, "Cause of the Bermuda Triangle." It's followed by "Wormhole to Parallel Universe" and "Origin of Both the Chicken and the Egg." Finally, we arrive at a curtain labeled "The Bottomless Pit." We pass through the curtain. It doesn't look like anything special. It's just a boring stone well in the middle of the floor. I'm disappointed. I lean over to have a look inside. Pitch darkness. "Careful," says the junior curator. "If you fall in, they'll never be able to get you out. You'll just keep falling forever." I don't even know how many times Dylan and I circle the pit. It just doesn't make sense. How do you get near the bottom of something that doesn't have a bottom? Dylan even tries dropping a quarter into the pit to see what happens. No surprise, it never hits the bottom.
"What now?" I say.
"Beats me," Dylan replies. I'm starting to sweat. Even Dylan keeps wiping his face with his sleeve. I keep thinking of other pairs completing their treasure hunts and getting their invitations to the finale while we bake in this hot room.
"Don't you guys have air conditioning in here?"
I ask the junior curator. He flinches.
"Wait, you flinched?"
He shakes his head. "Did not."
"I saw it too," says Dylan.
He wipes the sweat from his forehead.
"It must have something to do with the air conditioning."
"But what does air conditioning have to do with a bottomless pit?" I search the ceiling, then the walls. Finally, I look on the floor, and there they are.
"They've got floor vents!"
Dylan raises an eyebrow.
"Which means..."
"Think about it," I say. "They cut off the AC in here for a reason."
"Oh," says Dylan, "because we're supposed to go down there.
How much do you want to bet that one of the ducks goes right under the bottom of the bottomless pit?" Once we scramble over to the vent, I know I'm right. All the screws are missing. Dylan lifts the vent up, and a wide metal duct curves out of view.
"You're smaller, so you can probably get to the clue quicker," says Dylan.
I nod and drop down inside.
It's so dark down here. How will I know which way to go?
"Wait here," says Dylan. "I'll go to the bottomless pit and shout. Tell me if you hear an echo." A few seconds later,
"Hello!"
echoes softly in the distance. Dylan comes back.
"Could you hear me?"
"Yeah," I say.
"Just keep shouting."
Dylan disappears, and I start crawling. It's a little scary in here, but I concentrate on Dylan's voice.
"Just get to that voice."
I move down the duct, turn, and then turn again into dim light. A tiny little flashlight points upward. I crawl closer until I get to a photograph taped to the top of the duct. It looks like a large pirate ship falling over a waterfall. When I flip it over, I expect to find words, but it's blank. I've got no clue what it's supposed to mean. I grab the little flashlight and find my way back. I hand the photo to Dylan. He stares at it and then flips it over.
"The photo is all there was," I say.
"This is the edge of the world," says Dylan.
Last time I checked, the world is round. It doesn't have edges."
"It does have one, but it's hidden." We lock eyes and see at the same time.
The Department of Hidden Places.
We race to the elevators and dart between the legs of a tall green ogre about to step into Lucy.
"Sorry,"
I call back as the door is shut.
"We're in a hurry."
Lucy chuckles.
"Bet you're glad you got me. Where are we headed, guys?"
She zips us down to the underground tunnels, and we sprint past the neon sign that says, "Department of Hidden Places this way," or is it?
The best part about this being the final destination is that the secret to finding this department was written in ins and outs. I can even remember the page, 290. We keep our hands above our heads, even as the tunnels get dark, until I feel a large button graze my fingertips. I jump and give it a good press. Suddenly, the floor beneath us shivers and then lifts us up through the ceiling and into the lobby of the Department of Hidden Places. Enormous portraits of lost cities line the walls, with plaques revealing their names as Shangri-La, Avalon, and Shambhala. We dash over to an agent standing next to a small table. The lady looks us over.
"Very good. You two have officially completed all the clues and earned invitations to the finale. However, I must say that I find it extremely odd that the times this year were so much faster than in previous years. I'm more than a little suspicious. Did either of you hear anything about this tryout that might have given you an advantage? Cheating will not be tolerated." Dylan and I look at one another. We did hear something. It's how we knew to study ins and outs. Now that we've been caught, it makes me wonder how we ever thought we'd get away with it. These guys conduct investigations for a living. I can't believe I ruined Quentin's legacy like this. It's bad enough that Quentin's little sister is a cheater. I won't make it worse by lying. The agent smiles. "It's good to know that you didn't cheat." "Wait," I say. "We did hear something." Dylan starts at my words, but then he drops his head. "It's my fault. I heard the tryout was based on Bureau knowledge, and I told Amari about it. But I didn't tell him to report it, and I definitely studied my brains out to be ready." The agent crosses her arms, frowning. "I'm disappointed in both of you. To have elite badges and choose to cheat is a disgrace. I'm sorry to say this, but..." "Congratulations. You've officially passed the second tryout. You've shown the integrity and honest character befitting a future agent of the Department of Supernatural Investigations." It takes a few seconds to sink in. "You're saying we passed, even though we cheated?" The lady chuckles. "We leaked that information on purpose. This was not only a test of how well you decipher clues, but, more importantly, a test of whether you are honest when it is most difficult to be honest. Supernaturals must be able to trust you, as must your fellow agents." She hands us each an invitation from beneath the table, and Dylan and I laugh all the way back to the elevators. "We did it," says Dylan. "We really made it to the finale." I lean my head back against the wall and close my eyes.
"We've still got a chance to bring them home."
"They'd be proud of us," says Dylan. I can't get my words out, so I simply nod, tears running down my cheeks. Dylan takes my hand, and for a long time, we just stand like that. 26. That night, all the remaining junior agent trainees are called to the lobby of the Department of Supernatural Investigations. Only six of us show up. Other than me and Dylan, there's Josh Adams and Brian Lee, and then two of Laura's followers, Zoe Wisniewski and Madison Klein. Laura and Kirsten aren't here. I overhear Madison telling Brian Lee that Laura and Kirsten were actually the first to complete all the clues, but didn't fess up to getting inside information. When they told Laura she failed, she threw an epic temper tantrum so bad she may not be allowed to try out again next year if Agent Fiona has anything to say about it. Seeing as there are supposed to be eight trainees left, I guess Laura and Kirsten weren't the only ones who were disqualified. It might be the reason Agent Magnus pulled Dylan aside for a quick talk. If his sister really did fail the tryout, then he's probably feeling bad about teaming up with me. Agent Fiona lifts up her hands as she enters the lobby. Congratulations! The six of ye have proven to be the best. But now's no time to be resting on your laurels. There's only 7 days between now and the finale. What's your reward for getting this far? Well, I'm giving ye all your freedom. Ye can spend the next week however you'd like. Remember, the finale will test your supernatural world knowledge, your dueling skills with sky sprints and stun sticks, and your control over your supernatural ability. Spend this next week tightening up your skills in whatever areas you're weakest. The four of ye who score the best in these three areas will earn your junior agent badges and be assigned a senior agent or special agent to mentor ye for the last month of the summer session. You'll get to go out into the world and see what agenting is all about. Madison's hand goes up. Yes? She turns and points to me. I don't think it's fair that the rest of us have to demonstrate our supernatural ability and she gets to skip it. Agent Fiona glances in my direction. We haven't decided yet how we're handling Amari's situation. I heard she used a spell during her tryout, says Brian Lee. Isn't that illegal? Amari got permission from her chaperone, answers Agent Fiona. And while we aren't thrilled about it, our rules were to consult the chaperones for guidance on what's allowed. Seems like special treatment to me. Brian Lee shoots back. I say she should be disqualified, and Lara should be let back in. The others nod in agreement. It's a good thing it's not up to ye, isn't it? You're all dismissed. The others turn and head for the elevators, and both Zoe and Madison shoot me angry looks. I want to ask Dylan more about his sister, but before I get the chance, he follows Agent Fiona into the department. As much as I don't like Lara's stuck-up friends, they aren't wrong. It really isn't fair that I get to skip one section of the finale. I do have things I could demonstrate for them. I've been practicing my illusions for weeks. But would they ever let me show off my magic? I don't think I've ever seen this many people in the food court at one time, I say, as Elsie sits down at a table with me. Even though there are a lot fewer trainees than we started with at the beginning of summer, the place is packed with tutors and coaches of all kinds. For every kid, there are like 5 adults helping them to prepare for the finale, all retired bureau employees. It's easy to see why junior agent spots go to legacy kids. Even if you manage to get through the first 2 tryouts, how are you supposed to compete with kids who have a whole team around them? Elsie frowns. It's like their parents are buying them a spot in the bureau. But that's how it's always been. At least you don't have much to worry about, I say. And it's true. Elsie did great on her second tryout. The junior researcher trainees had to sit in a locked room and solve 7 puzzles. The last puzzle held the key that opened the door. The first 16 kids who opened the door got an invite to their finale. Elsie finished them all in 15 minutes flat and was the first to claim her invite. Neither do you, Elsie says. I know you'll make junior agent. Dylan plops down at our table. Sorry about Lara. I haven't been able to talk to Dylan since we found out his sister failed the tryout. Elsie and I still haven't told him about the whole keyholder thing. Even now, it's kind of hard to bring up. Yeah, Dylan says. She's pretty mad, and Dad agrees with her that it's my fault for not choosing her as my partner. As much as Lara and I don't get along, I still feel a spike of guilt. She's Dylan's sister, after all. Dylan starts to say something more, but laughter drowns out his words as Lara and a group of her friends surround our table. Lara's holding a laptop. Let's see here, says Lara. Amari Peters, recipient of the Jefferson Academy Scholarship for the Disadvantaged. Oh, how sad. Leave her alone, says Dylan.
Leave her alone, repeats Laura, glaring at her brother.
But I'm just getting started. She leans in closer to the screen. It seems you can take the girl out of the ghetto, but you can't take the ghetto out of the girl. Look at all these discipline referrals. Where did you get that? I'm so mad, I'm trembling. Laura looks to me, then her brother. Daddy left his computer laying around. Seems like he wanted to know all about his future juvenile delinquent superstar. Dylan stands up and snatches the computer away from Laura. Back off!
How dare you!
Shrieks Laura. She grabs Dylan's plate of spaghetti and tries to dump it over his head. Stop! I shout. And it does stop. A shimmering illusion of me appears, and she catches the plate of spaghetti in midair. She turns to look at me over her shoulder and winks. Gasps sound from the crowd of kids gathered around us. I stare at my outstretched hand. Did I really just do that? I decide to test it out. With a flick of my fingers, the illusion pushes the plate of spaghetti right into Laura's face. Whoa! Kids all around the food court point and laugh. My illusion vanishes, and Elsie scrambles around the table to where I'm standing. Laura snarls, "You are so dead." I swallow, but I'm not running away anymore. Mess with me or my friends again, and next time it'll be worse. Laura freezes, her expression suddenly unsure. She has no way of knowing what my magic is capable of, not after what I just did. I'll bet taking me on isn't a risk she's willing to take with so many kids watching. I take Elsie's hand and head to the elevators. Dylan stays behind to calm his sister. Once we're inside, I breathe a sigh of relief. Amari? Elsie stares at me, visibly confused. That thing with the spaghetti. I didn't know your illusions could do that. I look down at my hands and wonder. Me neither. There are three reasons I never get tired of our library. First, it's just so cool looking. Everything is made up of books. The floors, the ceilings, even the pillars between the bookcases. You can type in your book title at the computer catalog and get directions like 3 paces to the left and look down, or pillar closest to Fern, climb up halfway. The second reason is that there's just so many interesting things to read about, even aside from what I need to learn to become a junior agent. The third reason is Mrs. Bell, the librarian. She has this knack for knowing what you'd like to read just by looking at you. It's really helpful whenever I get burned out from studying the not-so-fun books from our book list. I don't care what anyone says. There's a reason Supernatural Laws and Regulations comes with a pillow on the cover. When I arrive at the counter, I'm glad to see that Mrs. Bell is here. Most of the other librarians aren't as nice. They either back away from the counter and talk to me from, like, 10 feet away, or they suddenly get busy doing something else and ignore me completely. Mrs. Bell adjusts her thick glasses and grins.
Another old news magazine from the archives, hun?
Not this time, I say. Any chance there's something new about Quentin that might have come in?
Just got a shipment of gossip magazines this morning.
Sure, they might use less than reputable sources, but some of your best information comes from less than reputable sources. You remember that when you become a big shot agent, you hear? I laugh, but Elsie rolls her eyes. A true researcher is a champion of facts, not make-believe. There's a reason they're shelved on the fiction side of the library. Mrs. Bell chuckles. Well, if you change your mind and get a hankering for a little make-believe, the computer catalog for the fiction section is right over there. I ignore Elsie's protests
and head straight over. What could it hurt? We've already read nearly everything else about Quentin. I type in Quentin Peters, and a list pops up on screen. One headline catches my eye. Rumors and whisperings. Famed agent kept secrets. Elsie, come look at this. What do you think?
I think we can do better, she says, walking over. Then she reads the headline, and her eyes widen.
I've heard of rumors and whisperings. The housekeepers swear by it. Maybe we should be thorough.
We both grin. The computer says it's located right above us, and sure enough, when I look up, the magazine drops from the ceiling and glides right into my arms. A thrill of excitement shoots through me. Elsie and I dash to the study hall at the opposite end of the library. Once we find an empty room, I take a seat at the desk, and Elsie pulls up an extra chair. I flip the magazine open. There are only two pages, a table of contents followed by a blank page. The table of contents reads, "Things aren't so rosy as Madame Dubois accused of stealing from rival. Great Wall of China mysteriously grows an extra 10 meters overnight, again. Dwarves insulted by Merlin's insinuation that Golden City is merely gold-plated. Newly elected U.S. president faints at first supernatural affairs briefing. Rogue carnivorous thunderclouds threaten air travel in South Pacific. Famed special agent kept secrets potentially locked away forever."
There has to be some kind of trick to it, says Elsie. We turn the magazine sideways, then upside down. We even shut off the lights to see if the words might glow in the dark. How in the world does this thing work? I say, annoyed.
Gotta ask me a question,
comes a low, deep voice. Elsie and I just stare. The magazine just spoke. You'd think we'd be used to this sort of thing by now.
Let's do a test run, says Elsie. What can you tell me about Madame Dubois stealing from a rival?
Madame Dubois's pale green face and flowing rose petal locks suddenly appear on the blank page. Beside it is a much younger face, white petals jutting out of her bright yellow scalp like a daisy.
Psst, listen up, comes a heavy whisper. Things got heated at an Evertree fashion show after both Madame Dubois and former understudy Vivi Laboum both unveiled nearly identical lines of translucent apparel for ghostly spirits. Laboum, who has long held that she was the real force behind Dubois's recent resurgence in popularity, before being unceremoniously fired, has accused Dubois of having a spy within her design circle. Dubois calls the accusations ridiculous, saying Laboum was fired for being a La Bum. Curious, then, that both were spotted laughing it up at Dubois's sprawling woodland estate. Publicity stunt, anyone? Course, you didn't hear it from us.
Elsie bounces in her chair. Scandalous. Grinning, I flip to the contents and then back to the blank page. Tell me about the special agent keeping secrets.
That's not a question, the magazine clucks. Mind your manners.
Fine, I say. Can you please tell me about the special agent keeping secrets?
Why, certainly.
The magazine replies. An image of Agent Magnus appears on the page.
Psst, listen up. Special Agent Quentin Peters is known for his heroics as one half of the famed agent team Vanquish. The pair went missing under highly suspicious circumstances about which the Bureau has remained extremely tight-lipped. But maybe they're seeking to protect his legacy more than anything.
It's customary for an agent to create a farewell briefcase to be delivered to a loved one in the event of a tragedy. And it was touching indeed that Quentin Peters chose to use his briefcase to offer Amari Peters a place at the Bureau. But one has to wonder, why then would an agent of reputable stature need a second farewell briefcase? What secrets did the Golden Boy need to hide so badly that he'd send it to old Magnus for safekeeping? If the conditions for opening the briefcase are never met, perhaps we'll never know. Of course, you didn't hear it from us. I slam the magazine shut and hop out of my chair, heading for the door. "Where are you going?" Elsie asks. "To find out more." I give Agent Magnus's door a good hard knock. "Are you sure we should bother him this late?" asks Elsie for the fifth time. "I have to know," I say. On my second knock, I hear movement inside. Magnus opens the door, just a crack.
"What do you want?"
"I know you've got my brother's second farewell briefcase," I say. Agent Magnus opens the door a little more.
"And where do you hear that?"
"Rumors and whisperings."
"Blasted gossip rag,"
Magnus groans.
"Bane of my existence."
"Well," I say, "do you?"
"Come in and shut the door behind you."
"Can my friend come in too?" I ask. "You've already met her, and I'll probably tell her everything anyway." "I'm really good at keeping secrets," Elsie says, crossing her heart. "Promise."
"Might as well," says Magnus. "Apparently top secret work is far from secret these days."
The office looks like a tree exploded in here. Everything is made of wood. Wood paneling on the walls, a big wooden desk, and hardwood floors. He's got a pair of long horn steer horns above his desk, and lots of pictures of him and other agents along the walls. There's a really big photo with Van Quish on a shelf next to his medals. Elsie and I take the two chairs in front of his desk.
"All right, so maybe I do have it," he says. "What's it to ya?"
"What's in it?" I ask, leaning forward. "Why did my brother need another briefcase?"
"Here's the thing about that," he answers. "I don't actually know what's inside. I've got a guess, but I don't know for sure."
"You mean you haven't opened it?" I ask.
"Wasn't meant to be opened," he says. "Quentin didn't put anyone's name on it. Just asked me to keep it hidden. Said whatever was inside was never meant to see the light of day."
Elsie and I turn to look at one another. Then I ask, "Do you think whatever's inside could get him in trouble?"
"That's a strange question."
Agent Magnus strokes his beard.
"What do you know?"
I meet Elsie's eyes again. If I tell the wrong person what we found, "I bet he already knows," she says. "His aura is a reddish orange, protective. I think he's been protecting Quentin all this time. That's why he claimed not to know about what Quentin was doing. We know about the Black Book." I lean back in my chair and add, "We also know that Quentin discovered the keyholder's identity. I think that's what he's keeping in that second farewell briefcase." Agent Magnus jumps in his seat.
"How on earth did you figure all that out?"
"Long story," I say. "What I don't understand is why he would search for the keyholder if he knows the horrible consequences."
"I won't say I agree with what he did,"
says Agent Magnus,
"but I do understand why he did it. It was clear when we raided Moreau's island that he was actively trying to resurrect his fallen comrade. Seems this Black Book has the power to do just that."
"And that's why Moreau's apprentice took my brother?" I ask, wanting to be sure. "To get him to reveal the location of the Black Key?"
"That would be the best case scenario,"
Agent Magnus comes from around his desk and places a hand on my shoulder.
They'd need your brother alive to learn what he knows. And if Quentin has refused to say anything, then there's a good chance he and Marie are still out there somewhere.
Please, oh please let that be true. The Black Book is still safe inside the Great Vault, right? Asks Elsie, like there's no way anyone could get to it.
Absolutely. It's the safest place in the whole supernatural world.
I shake my head. You guys didn't see Moreau's face. He was so sure of his plan.
All the more reason to get our hands on this apprentice as soon as possible and put an end to this, says Magnus.
For a second, I think to mention that my brother suspected Maria, but that wouldn't be treating her like she's innocent, and I promised Dylan that I would. Instead, I say, I want to help. I want to find my brother and bring Moreau's apprentice to justice. Magnus sighs and crosses his arms.
Quentin didn't want this life for you. But if you succeed in making Junior Agent and officially become part of the Bureau, then you'd stand to inherit all of his belongings. This briefcase, technically, becomes yours. Though it's likely the information inside made your brother a target. Not to mention what it could mean for the Bureau if word got out what Quentin was up to.
I'll keep Quentin's secret, I say. And I don't care about being safe. Or if there's a target on my back, too.
Gather that much when you ignored my warning and became a junior agent trainee in the first place, says Agent Magnus. Good or bad, you've got Quentin's same fire in your blood. That same stubborn determination, minus a setback or two.
I remember just how close I came to quitting junior agent training. Twice. Let me help, I say again. I'm sure my magic could help. Something buzzes on Magnus's belt. He unclips his phone and holds it up to his face.
Would this magic of yours have anything to do with the message I just got about you dumping a plate of spaghetti on Laura Van Helsing's head?
My face flushes. She was planning to dump it on Dylan, and I sort of lost my temper. Magnus snorts.
Well, if there's anybody due for a bit of spaghetti humbling, it's that Van Helsing gal. Kid was born with her nose turned up.
Then you're not going to kick me out of junior agent training?
Oh, I'm sure those phone calls will be coming any minute, says Magnus. It'll be a good time to trade in some of the goodwill you built up with the chief by meeting with Moreau. Besides, you've already got enough going against you. The chief is under a lot of pressure not to promote you to junior agent. A good many folks assumed you'd fail the second tryout, but now that you've made it to the finale, they're getting nervous. The idea of a magician inside the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs scares a lot of people.
But there have been magicians named Van Helsing inside the Bureau for centuries, I think. What am I supposed to do?
Only thing you can control is how hard you try, he replies. Make it as hard as possible to overlook you. Do that, and I'll do what I can to see that you get a fair shake. Understand?
I do. I say, I'm going to outwork them all. 27. Seriously, Amari? My eyes jump open to find Elsie standing in the doorway of our usual study room with her hands on her hips. That's got to be the most uncomfortable sleeping position ever, she says. I wasn't asleep. I say defensively, lifting my head. But now that I've pulled my face away from my book, I can see where I've drooled on the pages. Elsie sits down next to me.
You've been studying nonstop for days. You need to take breaks, you know, otherwise your head'll explode.
I've got to get through this book list, I say. And then I have to go back over all the stuff I read when I first got here because it feels like I can't remember any of it.
You haven't forgotten, says Elsie. You just haven't given your brain any rest. It's practically got steam coming off it.
Maybe she's right, because I can't even remember what the title of this book is. I slam it shut and yawn. What time is it? Breakfast? My jaw drops. You're joking. Please say you're joking.
Nope, she says. You spend the entire night face first in a book.
I rub my neck and groan. No wonder my neck feels so stiff. Wait, if it's already tomorrow, then I have to meet Dylan in the training gym. It's our last chance to practice the Helsing technique. It's their family stunstick style, and Maria taught it to Quentin. It's Amari, says Elsie. I know what the Helsing technique is, but maybe you should focus on going back to the room and taking a nap first. I'll tell Dylan you're going to be a little late. And brush your teeth, too.
Elsie pinches her nose to make her point. I cover my mouth. Sorry. I think I will take that nap. Hey, who needs a whole bunch of friends when I've got one Elsie?
When Dylan and I arrive at the training gym, there's a giant petition posted on the doors with the names of all the legacy parents who don't want me participating in the finale. Most of them aren't even from Supernatural Investigations, but they are current members of the Bureau of Supernatural Affairs. They've got their names and titles listed.
Maybe we could practice somewhere else today, I say to Dylan.
I say we train right in their faces. Dylan pushes open the door.
Are you sure? I ask. You don't worry about people going after you because of me?
Never, he says. Vanquished 2.0, right? I take a deep breath.
Okay, then. Let's do it.
The Helsing technique is just as hard as it looks, but Dylan is pretty confident we'll win our duels with just the basics. Quentin and Maria make it look so easy in all the footage we watch. One time, they even pulled it off hanging upside down from the ceiling. Those man-eating stalactites didn't stand a chance. We practice until we're both so exhausted, we just lie on the padded floor. I still haven't told Dylan about Quentin tracking down the key holder. Things were so weird between us with the whole Maria traitor thing. And now that there's a chance we could find out who this key holder actually is, it feels like we're close to a major discovery. We did promise to share whatever we found. I've got something important to tell you, I say.
What is it?
Dylan asks, sitting up. I sit up too and tell him everything we've learned.
This is huge, he says. If the Bureau can get to the key holder first, then maybe we can spring a trap for Morel's apprentice. This could be how we get Quentin and Maria back.
Only one problem, I say. I have to become a junior agent in order to inherit Quentin's second farewell briefcase. And there's a whole petition against me being in the finale.
You have to do it anyway, says Dylan, and prove that you deserve a place here.
But how? They'll never let me go on stage and show off my magic.
Use my turn, he says.
What do you mean?
When they announce me, he says, you go on stage instead.
You're serious? I ask.
We would be in so much trouble.
Dylan just laughs. You think my dad is going to let both his kids flunk the tryouts? Besides, if you don't do this, then you're giving him the excuse he needs to cut you. All he has to say is, you didn't fulfill all the requirements.
I don't know, I say.
Agent Magnus already said he'd try to help.
What's better? Asks Dylan. Hoping Magnus convinces enough people to feel sorry for you? Or going up there and taking a spot you should already have?
A mix of nerves and excitement washes over me. I do deserve my spot. A sneaky grin lights up Dylan's face.
Then tell me, how would you show off your magic?
Elsie dashes into our room, looking way too pleased with herself. She skips over to my side of the room, where I'm hunched over sovereign cities of the supernatural world, and plops down on the end of my bed.
I hope you're not planning on studying all day.
We're not all geniuses, I say, turning a page. Elsie lifts her chin, and I know immediately she's about to go on about something she's read.
You know, studies show that cramming the day before a big test is actually worse for you than just taking the day off.
I'm not cramming, I say, without looking up. This is the last book on my book list.
Fine, Elsie sighs. Study if you want, but promise me you'll keep tonight free.
I raise an eyebrow.
Why? What's happening tonight?
Just promise, okay?
Hold on. You're really not going to tell me what it is?
Nope, says Elsie. It's a surprise. Please just say you'll come with me. Please. It'll be so much fun.
As much as I'm tempted, there's a part of me that feels guilty for even thinking about it.
It doesn't feel right to have fun when Quentin is still out there somewhere.
You've been working super hard. And once you make junior agent, I'll barely ever see you while you're off with Agent Magnus working to get Vanquish back. Just come with me and have some fun tonight. You've earned it.
I guess you're right, I say.
Elsie claps her hands and squeals. Hope you're not scared of the dark. It takes me all morning and most of the afternoon to finish Sovereign Cities of the Supernatural World. Despite the boring title, it's pretty cool to learn about the non-human cities out there. Places like the underwater city of Atlantis, or the dwarven stronghold of Cibola, an underground city made completely of gold. It figures that it's located directly beneath Las Vegas. When I get back to my room, Elsie is waiting inside for me with a suitcase and a grin so wide I know I'm in trouble.
What are you up to?
So, tonight's festivities may involve sneaking out, says Elsie.
Sneaking out?
To where?
Good question, says Elsie.
Where is much better than why. Not that I'm answering either question. Just know that it involves these most splendid cloaks.
Are those Junior Undertaker cloaks?
Fresh from the Department of the Dead.
Something tells me I'm going to regret agreeing to this, I say.
Are you sure we won't get caught?
I mean, it would really suck to get thrown out the day before I make junior agent.
Don't worry, we won't be the only ones. At exactly 8:15 p.m., we get changed and join a large group of junior undertakers making their way to the elevators. Bertha stops and gives us a good looking over, but with the hoods of our cloaks pulled so low over our heads, we all look alike. Still, shouldn't she know by now how many junior undertakers there are? It's like she's just letting us go. Once we're on an elevator, Lucy gives us a tisk-tisk, someone's being naughty. Still, she zips us up to the Vanderbilt Hotel lobby without another word. Elsie and I follow the others down a side hall that leads outside where a bus is waiting. We sign the roll with made-up names. My roommate and I head to the very back of the bus. As soon as we find seats, Elsie pulls back her hood and grins. Done and done. I pull my hood off too. Maybe now you can tell me where we're going? Elsie rolls her eyes playfully.
You'll know soon enough.
Amari, says a voice I recognize. Dylan's head rises into view above the seat in front of us. I thought I heard you. He's got on a junior undertaker cloak too.
Are there any actual junior undertakers on this bus?
I ask. A few, he says. Sneaking out the night before the finale is kind of a tradition.
No wonder Bertha let us go so easily. I'm coming back there. Dylan climbs over the seat and plops down between me and Elsie.
Is this your first All Souls Festival?
All Soul Festival? I repeat. Are we going to a soul music concert? Mama would be so jealous. Elsie shoots Dylan a look and says, It's supposed to be a surprise.
Oh, my bad, says Dylan, looking back and forth between us.
Well, if it's your first time going, let's just say the name doesn't really give much away. The bus leaves the city, and we end up on an empty two-lane road. We pass through thickly wooded areas and farmland until eventually the bus pulls off onto a wide grassy field. A large crowd is gathered next to the road. I try to look past them all to get a hint at what the All Souls Festival might be, but the only thing that catches my eye is the full moon above. The three of us pull our hoods back on and follow the others off the bus. But when the junior undertakers move to the front of the crowd, Elsie grabs my hand and pulls me to the back.
Climb on my shoulders, says Dylan.
I'm not. Hurry, he insists. You'll miss it. Elsie nods enthusiastically. I take him up on his offer. On top of Dylan, I get a clear view of the junior undertakers spaced evenly in a straight line, their backs to the crowd. At the center is a senior undertaker whose cloak has a high silver collar. It looks like he's checking his watch.
Can they get on with it?
Says something that looks a lot like the boy version of Tinkerbell, his small wings buzzing in my ear. It's been midnight for 3 minutes already. Finally, the undertaker reaches into his cloak and brings a whistle up to his lips. He gives it a blow, and the junior undertakers raise their right arms in unison. Each one holds up a baton. By order of the Department of the Dead, working in conjunction with the foremost representatives of afterlife, I declare before the full moon that this month's All Souls Festival is now in session. The junior undertakers point their batons forward. Green light comes pouring out of them, and together, they draw a complex symbol of glowing green. The undertaker takes a step forward and says, Open, says me. The symbol flashes and then fades into nothing. Bright, colorful tents begin to emerge, spreading out over the entire field. Only they never fully take form. They stay hazy, almost translucent, like a strong gust of wind could blow them all away. The grass below my feet becomes black pavement, and little stands line the winding road ahead. Shimmering white figures swish back and forth along the road, calling us forward. Dylan drops me onto my feet, and I almost don't remember to catch myself.
Are those ghosts?
I ask.
Yep,
says Dylan. It's why they call it the All Souls Festival. Everyone's invited, living or dead. I don't get very long to decide how I feel about being surrounded by ghosts because Elsie whoops and tugs me by the hand behind the mass of people moving along the street. Dylan keeps pace, and we move through the crowd until we reach the first of the stands. I can't stop staring. Up close, the spirits look like people, only they're as shimmery and translucent as everything else here. A slender spirit with a thick mustache waves us over to his table.
Grab a bite of ghostly cotton candy. Eat as much as you want. You'll never get full.
I pat down my pockets for show. I'm sorry, but I don't have any money.
Wait, do you even take money?
Joss paper, says the spirit. Just have to burn it in my presence.
I turn to Elsie, who digs into her pocket. Dylan stops her.
I think my dad should pay for Amari's fun. Don't you?
He pulls out a thick roll of pink dollar bills and a lighter, and then sets a couple ablaze. Instead of burning up, though,
the bills only turn as shimmery as everything else in the festival. The spirit happily accepts the money and stuffs it into a jar.
"A pleasure doing business," says the spirit.
He hands me a small bag of glowing cotton candy, and I can't get the stuff into my mouth fast enough. The fruity flavor melts on my tongue. I've never tasted anything so delicious. Elsie, Dylan, and I move from stand to stand, trying all kinds of different goodies. I can't stop grinning after tasting a Strawberry Smiles flavored milkshake. Poor Elsie can't stop giggling after asking for a sample of the chocolate chip Chuckles flavor. Dylan and Elsie dare me to try Banshee ice cream, which seems like plain old ice cream to me, until the urge to shout my lungs out takes over after the third bite. Dylan and Elsie both go red in the face from laughing at me. Once we've tasted everything there is to taste, we head into a large tent called Sweet Dreams. The dreams in here all glisten, like liquid gold in little glass bottles. The sign says you only need one sip before bed to ensure you have the dream you want. Richest person in the world seems really popular, and so does most beautiful person in the world. I see a few people attempt to slip sweet, sweet revenge into their shopping baskets without anyone noticing. A group of teenagers swarms the "my crush wants to go out with me" counter and don't leave a single bottle on the shelf. Eventually, Dylan gets pulled away by some of his other friends, leaving me and Elsie to explore the rest of the festival on our own. We wander down a side street until I notice a jet black tent with a faded sign out front. Madame Violet's Magician Gift Shop. An actual store for magicians? Owned by the lady who wrote my spell book? We have to stop by that black tent, I tell Elsie.
What black tent? She replies.
Right there. It's like directly in front of us. Elsie squints.
I'm looking, but I don't see any black tents.
Just follow me. I lead Elsie closer until we're standing right in front of the entrance.
Still don't see it?
Elsie looks at me sideways.
All I see is an empty alleyway.
Weird. Come on, maybe you'll be able to see it once we're inside. I step through the entrance, and the sharp smell of spices stings my nose. A skinny spirit wearing long dreadlocks sits cross-legged behind a black kettle. That must be Madame Violet. She grins at me from the center of the dimly lit space.
You couldn't have seen my tent unless you've magician's magic in your blood. You must be the famous Amari Peters. I read about you in this week's Dearly Departed.
I am Amari Peters. I glance around at the bottles lining her shelves. A bottle marked Broken Promises shimmers with a soft blue light. Another silver vial says Shattered Dreams. Unrequited Love has a bright red glow. Greatest Hopes sparkles in gold. Elsie comes in behind me.
This really is a tent. I thought for sure you were seeing things.
I step closer to the lady behind the kettle.
Are you the same Madame Violet who wrote my spell book?
The spirit shuts her eyes and grins.
Do you imagine that there are many magicians named Madame Violet?
Probably not, I reply.
Madame Violet has a purring laugh.
Put the book to good use, child. Magic is a living thing. It does a dead woman no good. Shall we get down to business?
The spirit leans closer and strokes her chin.
The knowledgeable girl lacks courage, while the courageous girl lacks knowledge. How interesting. I'll make a deal with you, she adds. If the dragon girl pays a small price, the magician girl can get knowledge vital to her quest.
My quest? I ask.
This is not the first time I've seen your face, says Madame Violet. When I was living, I would cast my magic far into the future and marvel at the scenes my illusions would show me. I saw who you were speaking to, Amari, and the spell you cast. I can assure you, this is a future you desperately want to preserve, and that can only happen with my help. Elsie pulls out some Joss paper from her pouch. Madame Violet clucks her tongue. I do not deal in common currency. For this, I shall require one secret withheld from a friend.
A secret?
My roommate shivers. The spirit's expression darkens. There isn't anything you've kept from your friend here? Certainly she couldn't hold it against you if revealing it is for her own benefit. Elsie glances to me, then drops her head.
Well,
hush, says the spirit. Don't waste it. Give me your hand. At first, I think there's no way Elsie will agree to this, but then she extends her hand. Wait, I say.
I can do this for Quentin, Elsie says.
But I watch helplessly as the spirit takes Elsie's hand into her shimmering palm.
Repeat these words, says the woman. I pledge a secret withheld for a single bit of advice for my friend.
Elsie nods and repeats the words. A burst of cold air fills the tent, making me shiver. My roommate lowers her head and turns to face me.
The first night we met, I told you that I didn't know why I haven't shifted yet. The truth is that I do know. I found it in a book ages ago. Where dragons were once fierce warriors, and because of that, in order to shift, we have to perform a great act of courage. But I've been a warrior and a scaredy cat my whole life. I didn't tell you because I'm ashamed.
The woman takes out a small net and swings it through the air between us. She hurriedly drops the net into an open jar labeled Secrets Among Friends. The black liquid swirls, going from nearly empty to half full.
I'm sorry, says Elsie.
I take her hand.
It's totally fine. We had just met, remember? I thought you were going to say you snore like a lawnmower on purpose.
Elsie laughs and gives my hand a gentle squeeze.
Very good, says Madame Violet. And here's the knowledge that was promised. An illusionist should never trust that which giggles and grins.
I just stare.
Is that all? Am I supposed to know what that means?
Madame Violet cackles as she and the entire shop begin to fade away. Soon Elsie and I are standing alone in an alley between two larger tents. It's like the shop was never here.
Well, that was strange, says Elsie.
Very strange.
There she is, comes Kirsten's voice from the main road. I told you I saw her come down this way.
Elsie and I turn to find Laura and Kirsten coming in our direction. Laura balls her fists.
You think you can throw spaghetti in my face and get away with it?
Whatever made her hesitate back at the bureau is gone. She looks furious.
I glance around me for an escape, but the only way out of this alley is forward, right into Laura.
Just let Elsie go, I say.
Please.
So she can run off and tell someone? Says Laura.
Nope, you're finally going to get what's coming to you.
She sets her jaw and steps closer. I shove Elsie behind me. Laura dashes forward and kicks out her leg. It's so fast, I don't even have time to react. I just feel my legs get knocked from under me and land hard on my side. Next thing I know, she's on top of me, pinning both my wrists above my head with one arm. That means she's still got one hand free. She balls it into a fist. I wriggle and buck my legs, but it's no use. Her ability makes her too strong. Laura winds up her punch, and I panic. I stare into her eyes and scream, "Magnophobia!" Laura's eyes go wide as the world around us shifts.